Welcome to the Bloodcast. I am Ryan Turk, the managing editor of shocktillyoudrop.com, and this is episode 87.
Allegedly.
Allegedly. There is a mystery episode that's lost somewhere. If you guys noticed, if you download us on iTunes, there is a jump in episode number and, mistakes.
You know what? Maybe they brought somebody else in. Maybe they brought another team in while we were off for our weekend.
Yeah.
Who knows? Hello, everyone. My name is Clark Wolf. It's nice to see you.
And in this episode, we are going to be covering the films of Guillermo del Toro. And I'm very excited about this one.
Me too. Excited. We've been talking about doing this one for a while. I know I've wanted to do it for a while.
And we're doing it on the day that FX has officially renewed The Strain.
Did they release a thing today? Okay.
It is 9:54 Pacific right now. They're telling me to embargo this until 10 a.m. But guess what, guys? I'm 6 minutes early in the future.
In the future.
Something, because you guys are going to listen to this tomorrow.
So anyways, it's the past.
I don't know.
Days of future past.
Doc Brown, where are you?
Yeah.
We're going to be covering the films of Guillermo del Toro. And before we do that, I've got some things I want to discuss. I'm sure you have some things you want to like catch up on, because you and I have not had like QT time.
It's true.
A little time between Clark and I since I've been gone.
It's been a while.
Since, you know, you brought in a third wheel last week.
Oh my gosh.
Nick,
yes.
I love you.
Nick McCarthy is the definition of a third wheel.
Nick is great, because after last week's episode, he started Instagramming photos of car posters, the car posters, foreign posters to me. And then yesterday he tagged me in a Facebook post. He was like, yo, here's your ride. And it was somebody had recently outfitted a car to look like the 1970s version of the car. And I was like, fuck, man, I need to get one of those.
Nice.
Yeah. Except imagine me driving around in one of these like low riding the car, which looks like the size of like, I don't know, three. What are the cars? The little ones, the little Fiats.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Like five Fiats put together. Like that's how long they could be.
That sounds ridiculous.
It is ridiculous. So what have you seen? What would you like to catch up on?
Oh, well, that's nice of you. well, we didn't talk about The Guest.
Oh yeah, The
last
Guest.
Week. And I just wanted to say to our listeners out there, The Guest is the new movie from Simon Barrett and Adam Wingard. Mm-hmm. And it comes out in September. And it's already been screening, on the festivals.
Yeah, the festival circuit. It stars Dan Stevens from Downton Abbey.
Yep.
And apparently everybody's got a little crush on that guy.
Oh, my gosh.
I'll say I got a little man crush on him after seeing The Guest. He's definitely the embodiment of manlyhood.
Of cool.
And of cool, yeah.
He's super cool.
Yeah,
and
he's a cool cucumber.
Yeah, and, you know, it's funny because I don't watch Downton Abbey, and so I have no previous knowledge. Like, I looked Dan Stevens up after the movie and saw he has all these credits like Masterpiece Theater and like, you know, I mean, because he's like a young British actor, and young British actors, much in the way of, I think, Benedict Cumberbatch and others, do a lot of these period like TV, you know, like playing a handsome young man in times long past or something. Mm-hmm. But I've never seen Downton Abbey, so I had no idea.
Yeah, and I don't know.
Apparently his character on Downton is rather Hugh Grant-ish in like bumbly and kind of awkward and all these things. And, you know, hearing about that after the fact, I was just like, wow, well, not in this movie.
Yeah.
But anyway, I, you know, you guys know if you listen to our show that I was not the biggest fan of Your Next last summer, which is also Adam and Simon. But this movie, I think, is my favorite thing I've seen all year. And I haven't seen as much as you have, obviously.
I just loved
every minute of it.
It's the real deal. It's a lot of fun. It's, you know, there is a throwback nature to this film. I love that this is what Adam Wingard and Simon Barrett are doing, is they are paying respect to films that we love without being completely inundated by the sense of nostalgia.
Yeah.
They are smart enough to put their own stamp on things with their own unique voice. You know, after seeing Your Next and The Guest, you know, paired together, you would definitely pick up on the fact that that there is a signature to these films, you know, that they have a personality. There's a certain rhythm to the dialogue. There's a certain humor above all, you know. I mean, The Guest is funny.
It's so funny.
It's super funny.
Well,
as violent and as grim as it can get sometimes, you know. I mean, it's a great movie, and we should probably set up what the plot is.
Sure. Yeah. It's about a guy, a young man played by Dan Stevens, who basically shows up at the door of one of his, he served in Iraq, mm-hmm. and one of his former colleagues yep. who has fallen, who's died. Caleb is the character's name, whom we never meet. But he knocks on the door of his mother and says, hello, like, I made a promise to Caleb. I would come and tell you that, you know, he loves you and blah, blah, blah. And of course, Dan is very charming and handsome and all of these things. And so the mom is like, oh, wow. And, it, you know,
she's a little
really,
frail. She's a little weakened by the fact that her son died.
Yeah, she's still very much feeling it and mm-hmm. feeling that loss. And to have this sort of, you know, memory kind of come to her door, she welcomes him in. She invites him in. And then, you know, we find out that Dan, there might be more to Dan than
there is a lot
meets
more.
The eye.
Yeah, it is true. Yeah. But
something I wanted to mention, though, is so the screening that we saw, was that the first time you saw it?
Yeah.
Okay. So the screening we saw a couple of weeks ago had a Q&A after Nicholas Winding Refn, the director of Drive, did a Q&A where he hosted it and moderated with Simon and Adam. And, you know, the general consensus on Twitter is that most people enjoyed this Q&A. I did not particularly enjoy the Q&A because I think that Refn wanted to be the star of the show.
Refn came out, just to give a little setup, Refn came out onto the stage with sunglasses on.
Yeah.
And he sat down. But, you know, he countered everything. He countered the kind of pompous pretentiousness, whatever, with something very congratulatory, because he came out on stage with the sunglasses and then he introduced Adam and Simon as the future of cinema.
Yeah, totally.
Which was like, okay, cool. So you're not putting anything on.
Yeah.
You know? But then the Q&A just
was just ridiculous. And honestly, like, Q&As are hard to do. I think they're an art form in and of themselves. Yeah. Good moderators are hard to find.
Yes.
And sometimes directors interviewing other directors could be a blessing. It's an amazing thing. But sometimes it's a little weird. What I will say is that if I hadn't enjoyed the movie so much mm-hmm. and wanted to hear everything about making the movie and sure. these choices and what I had just seen, I probably wouldn't have been as annoyed, like, kind of like, come on, let them talk, because I actually really want to know.
Yeah. They did go on a few interesting tangents. I mean, after they moved past the uncomfortable nature of the Q&A, in which, like, you know, Refn was grilling Wingard on a few things, and Wingard at like one point was like, I don't know what you want me to do, man.
Yeah,
I should probably just, I'm gonna sit back and be quiet, you mm-hmm. know, because everything I'm saying is wrong to you. Barrett wisely turned the Q&A onto Refn, and then it turned into a conversation you might have left out. A lot of people, you, Brian Collins, a bunch of people just stood up and left. Barrett then turned the conversation onto Refn, and then it became a filmmaker conversation,
right.
which was engaging and it was enlightening, but then it just kind of turned back into this weird little circus.
Well, I will also say that I told Adam and Simon, because I was interviewing them a day or two later on behalf of Nerdist for the guest, and I told them, I was like, you know, it's kind of an advantage that I got a chance to see this Q&A, because every time the moderator would cut you off or start, I can follow up and ask all these new questions. And they were like, oh, they laughed. and they were like, that's awesome. And they were like, yeah, we don't know what happened. We were doing our best. And I was like, I told them, I said, well, the Q&A going off the rails had nothing to do with anyone on this phone call.
Yeah,
to which they laughed again. But, you know, I don't want to really even talk too much about the guest, because I think people need to just enjoy it with a blank slate.
Yeah, listen, I mean, it's funny. It's action-packed. It's not specifically horror. However, it has horror elements to
it. Totally.
You know, if you're a big soundtrack nut like I am, you're going to love this score.
I loved the score too.
Synth driven. It was by one of the guys who was part of the band Zombie. And I've kind of fallen out like of being up to date as to what Zombie's been up to. But I remember I discovered them in 2004 mm-hmm. because they were very synth driven. And then I just kind of lost track as what they were up to. And then, one of the main dudes did the score for this, using, I guess, the same synthesizer that Carpenter used for Halloween 3. Mm-hmm. So that gave me all the feels. It was great.
So many feels. And the other thing I wanted to mention is that Adam and Simon sort of described the movie as Halloween meets the Terminator, which I thought is 100% the right way to describe the movie, because the whole time I was watching the movie, that's all I could think of. Mm-hmm. But it is not, you know, but yeah, it's, so I think that's a perfect way to describe it. And I'm not going to go into it anymore, except, what was I going to say? about that.
Halloween Turner.
Oh, well, and also I think they complement each other because, you know, I've always felt like in the same way that I think Alien is a horror movie and Aliens is an action movie, I feel very much that Terminator is a horror movie and Terminator 2 is an action movie.
Oh, sure.
So I think that they're really nice bedfellows. Mm-hmm. And that's what I want to say.
Yeah, the guest is phenomenal. I really, really enjoyed it. It was a pleasant surprise and I kind of, you know, kicked myself for not missing it at the festival circuit partake in that love. All the love that happens at the festivals.
Well, but you know, this is a real crowd.
Yeah, it was. I saw a film that you hopefully will enjoy. I never know. Clark and I had a text conversation that was great because we were talking about stuff in the podcast.
The Babadook. I'm so excited for the Babadook.
No, don't you turn this conversation around. Okay. And you were like, you mentioned Babadook and you were like, oh, I heard it's great. Is it great? And I was like, yeah, I liked it. It's very good. I think it's very good. And then I was like, I don't know what you'd like anymore, Clark. I really don't.
Whatever.
There's a film I saw.
I like good things. That's what I like.
Ouch. I saw a film at Fantasia called The House at the End of Time. Mm. And it was from, I believe, Venezuela. And it's playing at Scream Fest here in Los Angeles. What happened? Was something in your coffee?
Yes, coffee grinds. So if I have coffee grinds in my teeth for the rest of the show, Ryan, that's going to be a treat for you.
Gnarly.
Okay, sorry. Please continue.
It's a film called House at the End of Time, a Venezuelan horror film. And I thought it was phenomenal. It's really, really interesting film. It is playing a Scream Fest in October. So you're going to have to go check it out. Okay. But it's just a film that pulls in classic haunted house elements with a little bit of Amblin. Mm-hmm. And it's basically about most of the focus is on the wife, mm-hmm. but it's about a mother trying to hold her family together. And in the opening minutes, I'll give you the little bit of setup. She's laying on the ground in a bloody mess. She goes down into the basement. She finds her husband. Husband dies. And then her only child that we see disappears. And then she's set up for all of it. Like she gets arrested for all of it. She gets arrested for the kidnapping, the murder. And of course, they can't find a kid, so it's missing. And then they flash forward many, many years later. And it's basically kind of like Oculus in a way that it tells two stories, one in the past and one in the present, and how they collide. Mm. And holy crap, it's fucking cool.
It's awesome.
It's really, really creative. It's very, very heartfelt. It's got it's just a really mature filmmaking from someone. I believe that this is their first film too. And I was just like, wow, man, I can't wait. I'm sure that someone along the way is going to see this and go, we need to remake this because it's that good. My understanding is that Dark Sky Films picked it up. I don't think they've announced that yet. I don't know. But that's what I heard through the grapevine. And if you're in the Los Angeles area, check it out at Scream Fest because it is great.
Cool.
Yeah. Yeah. What else did you see?
I wanted to mention to Amanda Oakes, one of our listeners. She had asked us a long time ago, I think on Facebook, if we had seen Lake Mungo.
Oh, yeah.
Have you seen that?
I haven't.
I have. I watched it. Yeah. It was on TV when I was house sitting a few weeks ago.
The remake or the original?
The Australian one.
Okay.
Wait, was it a remake?
Never remade it. Never mind. I'm sorry. My nerd brain is getting all confused. I know that they were trying to remake it and they never did.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
Well, so I watched it and, it's a cool, she asked what our thoughts were on it. Mm-hmm. And I just wanted to mention that it's very, 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 very slow burn. but the acting, I thought, and the direction, it is a found footage type thing, or it's like a docudrama. It's kind of like one of those things where, you know, somebody goes missing and the news crew comes, like an ABC or a Dateline or something like that, and they're like, so tell us. And then, you know, they explain, like they put all the pieces together and they kind of, you know, explain what happened and all of that. Look, the truth is, when I was really thinking about it, I was like, this doesn't make any sense. Like, why would this be effective? Because they keep telling you little things, and then they go, that's not what it appears, or it's actually something different, and perhaps the supernatural isn't involved, but maybe it is. Yet, the script does not feel incoherent to me. And I think it's a testament to the filmmaker and the performances that they are able to just keep you on the hook, mm-hmm. even though they're telling you, like, no, actually, it's not a ghost. This is what it is. But then it comes back and perhaps Supernatural is involved. I know, like, Ryan's giving me a very skeptical looking face.
It looks like, sounds like it's all over the place. Man.
I know it sounds like that. Yeah. I know it sounds like that. But the thing is, it doesn't feel, to me at least, it didn't feel incoherent.
Okay.
There's a lot of stuff that gets thrown at you, but I feel like it's just a, I don't know.
You just have to be there.
Yeah, I think so. I really think so. You just have to like be in it, just be in it. And again, it's not terrifying. It's not edge of your seat. It's just this very slow burn, supernatural-ish exploration of a young woman who, was growing up and stuff was hard for her. And
now this is a film that pops up every once in a while that we are asked about, or it comes up in comment boards when it comes to articles about real true cases, stuff like that. Why do you think that? What's the enduring power of this film? Is there anything that people are latching onto specifically? Because it's a film that people talk about regularly. Like I said, whether it's on comment boards or on Twitter or on Facebook.
I like the performances. To me, they feel like real people. Mm-hmm. There's one instance where it didn't really feel like a real person was telling the story, and it was a very small, small role. But I think the parents are very believable. I think the acting is very, it feels like these are real people, me at least. And, also and we've talked about this many times, I feel like, horror films or genre films rather, that resonate are often family melodramas where something out of the ordinary happens. Mm-hmm. And this is one of them. I mean, how well do you know your teenage daughter?
Right.
What is she getting into? What's going on down the street? What's going on with the neighbors? Do you really know the people you're surrounded with all of the time? Mm-hmm. Whether or not there are ghosts involved it doesn't necessarily matter.
Yeah.
I don't think.
Okay.
But yeah, I mean, look, I could see how this would be a very divisive movie. I could see how people at the end would go, "What? That was a waste of 90 minutes." But for me, in this case, I felt like it worked.
Right. Excuse me. Cool. Yeah. I haven't seen it. It's just one of those ones that, it lands on a radar and then you kind of like flirt with it, like, well, maybe you should check it out. And then it blows up because I think After Dark Films released it here in the States as part of their 8 Films to Die For. Oh, and then I just missed it and it just kind of like blew away. One of these like rainy afternoons, I'll have to just check it out.
And that was the thing. I mean, I'm not going to lie to you. I was house sitting. It was a Sunday morning. I was making breakfast. It was on. I was watching it and I was like, oh, cool. I'm going to go get some coffee. Mm. And it was, it's just on and I'm enjoying it. But I wasn't captivated,
right.
And like, oh, what is happening? I have to focus.
Yeah.
But I liked it. Cool movie.
One other film I just want to mention that I saw at Fantasia, just because I haven't been able to talk about like the good stuff.
Right.
There was a film called When Animals Dream. Mm. And it's a film that could be like a good sister piece to Ginger Snaps.
Oh.
You might actually dig this one. This doesn't have the kind of attitude that Ginger Snaps mm-hmm. has. It's a little bit more, it's a quiet, slow burner one. And it's just basically about a young girl who realizes that she's she inherited something from her mother. And now that she's a teenage girl, she's going through those changes. Very similar beats.
Sure.
But it has a more of a town-wide impact. Because the town is in on what's going on to this girl, so they understand she becomes the town-wide misfit,
uh-huh.
and they found a way because her mother's still alive and her mother's still her mother still succumbs to this lycanthropy thing that mm-hmm. happens. They found a way to kind of suppress it, and this teenage girl basically stands up for herself and is like, no, I won't be doing this. And I won't be going through this bullshit that you have been going through with my mother year after year. Really good. Really good. It's a cute and not cute, but it's a really good movie. I mean, it's got, I say cute because it's got like some really good humor to it.
Uh-huh.
But it takes itself very seriously. And I kind of wish they went further with it because I feel like we've seen this story time and time again. And I said to somebody on my way out, I was like, well, I can't wait for the second film so we can actually see where a story like this vaults to, mm-hmm. I'd like to see what the next stage in her life is now that she's kind of put her foot down and has said no,
yeah.
But yeah, it's an interesting movie. I don't know. I think a Weinstein company picked it up. So who knows?
So we'll never see it.
Who knows when we're going to see this freaking movie. And then finally, I want to mention too that if you are a filmmaker out there, this applies to everybody within the U.S., of course, and around the world. Beyond Fest is coming up out here in Los Angeles. It's a great festival that takes place September 25th to October 5th at the Egyptian Theater. And I am going to be programming the horror short film selection with Spencer Hickman and Christian Parks over at Beyond Fest. And it's going to be a Shock Till You Drop.com presents thing. So go to beyondfest.com and submit your short film. I mean, we'll have all the rules and regulations there. But if you have a short horror film, we want to see it. So I just want to throw that out there. I'm really excited about this year's fest. It's going to be rad.
Great.
Yeah.
Great, great.
Anything else before we move on to our love of Guillermo del Toro?
I don't think so.
All right, cool.
I think we're ready for that.
Excellent. At this point, we should play music. No, I'm kidding.
Our love music?
Just like, no, just like Guillermo stuff. So Guillermo del Toro, the reason why we wanted to kind of focus our director series on this guy, one, because it's a long time coming. Guillermo's great. Also, because The Strain is currently on the air on FX. And I've been enjoying The Strain. I know it's got a lot of flaws and I've got some problems with it. Mm-hmm. But I also feel like it has its roots deeply seated in the world of Guillermo. Guillermo is all over the place, even though he's not directing it. Guillermo is making Guillermo has been saying in the press that regardless of who's directing or who's writing, his fingerprints are all over it. I mean, he's color timing every episode. Mm. Color timing. That's such an interesting creative choice to make, like if you're going to get involved. But Guillermo, man, I love him.
I love him too.
I think he's amazing. And going back through, basically, like I know a lot of his films kind of like by heart, like Mimic, Hellboy, Hellboy 2. So I went back and I wanted to revisit his smaller efforts as, you know, international films like Kronos and Devil's Backbone and stuff like that. So let's start.
Great.
Awesome.
Shall we start with Kronos?
Let's start with Kronos.
I can't remember. Since I've been on the Bloodcast, did we talk about Kronos? I don't think we have.
I don't know.
I don't think we have because I watched it in the last house I was living in.
Okay.
And as I came onto the Bloodcast is when I was leaving that house.
Yeah.
So I watched.
Is Kronos your first introduction to Guillermo? What was the first film that you went, oh, this is the first Guillermo film I've ever seen?
That's a really good question. The one that really put him on the map for me was Pan's Labyrinth.
Okay.
Because I saw it at the Cannes Film Festival, and I saw it early, meaning I saw it, you know, in May, and it came out at Christmas or whenever it came out. That was the one, and I had been reading because I had been reading JoeBlow.com forever, and that was sort of one that they previewed.
Okay,
and I made sure to go to a screening of it because I knew Guillermo. I researched Guillermo, and I knew he had done Hellboy. I guess that was a Mimic. I remembered hearing about the movie Mimic when I was a kid, when younger. And but I read the synopsis of Pan's Labyrinth. And as you know, I like fantasy and I like fairy tales. So I definitely wanted to check it out.
Yeah.
And that was the one. I remember specifically walking out of that movie. I actually walked out next to Samuel L. Jackson. I remember that. But I remember walking out of that movie and being like, this is the thing.
Yeah.
This is the thing out of this festival that is going to be huge when it comes out.
Nice.
And I remember going home and telling everybody about that movie. So that was what really put him on the radar for me. And that was in 2006. So what I did was go back and watch Hellboy and Hellboy 2 after that.
Okay.
You know what I mean? Because I hadn't seen the movies as they were coming
out. Right. I was introduced to Guillermo through Fangoria. Uh-huh. And they were doing a top 10 filmmakers to watch thing. And Guillermo was on that list. And, you know, Kronos had come out, I think, in limited release in New York. But I actually saw it on VHS. I went down to Kim's Video and rented it. And was immediately spellbound by it. You know, I thought it was just such a unique voice and such a unique film. And then just kind of followed him through, you know, in chronologically correct order. You know, because when Kronos came out and then Mimic, I went and saw that opening night. And then, yeah, just kind of went through that way.
Well, I remember, well, not remember, I had wanted to see Kronos for a while, and I finally watched it last year. And I remember really feeling like it was a first feature. Mm-hmm. It felt like his first movie. And, sure. and there was, you know, you can obviously point to, for instance, when I was rewatching Hellboy the other day, I felt like John Hurt's character really kind of looked like the grandpa.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, like there are, he has, and I think this is why he's perfect fodder for the Bloodcast director series, because he is a real auteur. He really does have all the things that go into what makes, you know, what supports auteur theory.
Yeah.
So anyway, Kronos, I liked it. I remember, but you know, I've been spoiled because I've seen where he's gone. And so it's fun to go back and see where they come from. Oh, but yeah. at the same time, you know, you kind of go, it's a little slow. And I mean, but I mean, I'm not criticizing sure, it. I'm sure. just saying, like, I remember enjoying it, and I'm glad that I watched it. And again, those fairy tale elements, the grandfather, the mentorship, and, you know, the all those kinds of things I appreciate and I like. So that was my take with Kronos.
Yeah, I think it's a beautiful film. It's definitely a first-timer's film. In terms, but it's in such an impressive
yes,
first-timer's
yes,
film.
Yes.
I mean, like, I kept reminding myself, holy crap, this is his first movie. This is his first feature. And I think I was watching, I don't know, the director's chair on El Rey, and they had Guillermo del Toro on, and he was saying something like, oh, yeah, you could definitely... He's like, I like it, you know, but I have other films that I like more. Mm-hmm. But I think I got the feeling he was being a little too hard on himself. But man, oh man, I mean, like, even though it's a deliberately paced film, mm-hmm. I think that there is so much beauty in everything that he does, and especially this film. The thing is that Guillermo's films aren't necessarily scary, mm-hmm. but they get under your skin,
mm-hmm.
and he brings beauty to horror. You know, in the production design and the lighting yeah. and the characters, I'm never really scared by anything. I'm fascinated more than anything, you know? You know, when it comes to, you know, the Kronos device, there's nothing really scary about it. There's just a creepy bug that, you know, you have like a liquid transference with. You give it something, it gives you something back, and then voila, you know? And then you have this power. What are you going to do with it? This immortality, you know? And, I don't know. I just love, when it comes down to the breakdown of Guillermo's films, Kronos ranks really high, regardless of its flaws and regardless of everything, because I love that at its core, and I'm sure Guillermo had other things he wanted to say. This film felt like it was all about the, you know, the secrets that adults share with kids.
Yes.
You
yes.
know, and in this case, you have this grandfather and this little girl, and it's just such a beautiful relationship. And it's just obviously such an extreme take on, you know, the secret. And in this case, the little girl handles it so wonderfully, you know, she's just this little misfit girl who doesn't talk.
Mm-hmm.
And I, you know, one of my favorite scenes is literally when he comes up to her like little shack on the roof. And then she puts him in the toy box mm-hmm. because he needs to sleep and she wants to keep him out of the sun. And I'm like, this movie's fucking great.
Well, and also you're tapping into and you're hitting on, I think, the main major themes that are in all of his movies throughout mm-hmm. his entire body of work. A fable,
yeah.
You know, whether it's a vampire fable or yeah. or otherwise, you're touching on family. Family is, I noticed, especially rewatching Hellboy, and also I have just gone to a preview of The Book of Life, which he produced. He didn't direct, but he was there.
Oh, nice.
And they both, the director and Guillermo, did a Q&A.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that throughout his whole body of work, you really see how important family is. And you see how these children always have agency. Meaning a lot of times kids are portrayed as, oh, I'm just a kid and I don't know anything. But there's a lot of people who think that children really, really are, you know, human beings, like they're little people.
Yeah.
And you can give them a little more credit yeah. than maybe we normally do. And I think that's a theme that goes throughout the yeah. entire body of work. So really, Kronos, I think, is a perfect introduction
mm-hmm.
to
everything.
Yeah.
All of his motifs are there, you know, from color schemes to this fascination that he has with insects, mm-hmm. you know, insect life, culture, whatever, you know, there's this strange parallel that he draws between the two of them. I don't know whether, I mean, like, I'm sure it's different for each one, but you know, insects work in a very deliberate way and they can easily be crushed and all this stuff. You know, there's just so much to be said there. And there's a line from Cronus I had to write down because it was just so wonderfully Guillermo. It's Christ walked on water just like a mosquito. Mm-hmm. And it's like, oh my God.
Yeah.
So good, you know? Yep. And it's just, and that carries through everything. And Cronus, you know, just wanted to say, I mean, Cronus definitely set the bar in terms of what we can expect from vampires, mm-hmm. From Guillermo, because a lot of stuff bleeds through into Blade 2 and it bleeds through into The Strain. Mm-hmm. There's literally a moment in The Strain where a guy is licking blood off the floor. Like, what's the actor's name? Federico Lupi. Federico, Jesus Grease is his name in the movie, is licking blood off the floor. And I was like, oh, of course, you know, and reading this book, Guillermo del Toro, Cabinet of Curiosities, you know, it's basically an exploration of all of his sketchbooks and notes and stuff like that. Buy this book, because if you want to know the ins and outs of Guillermo del Toro, all of the gears here are in place, to give you a better understanding of his work. And it's interesting because, you know, there's a chapter in this book about Cronus, and he's like, oh yeah, that sketch there. And it's like a little mini sketch. He's like, I called that back in The Strain because I wasn't able to put it in the first movie. Mm-hmm. And it's like, oh my God, this guy, he operates on such a level where nothing gets lost. He doesn't lose focus of anything. It's all in his head. And I don't know how he compartmentalizes it all, because I mean, like, Devil's Backbone was written before Cronus, mm-hmm. and yet that stayed at the forefront of his mind as something that he wanted to create and pull off. You know, notes and sketches from Cronus are now relevant in The Strain. And that was so many years ago, it's insane.
This is similar also to that Tim Burton exhibit, the art of Tim Burton that made its way through the US a couple of years ago.
Yeah.
And, you know, the thing that I always was so amazed by is that, you know, the cool thing about that exhibit is that it was the art of Tim Burton. It wasn't the costumes and props of Tim Burton.
Yeah.
And what it was it was his sketches, very similarly, creatures, characters, molds, short films, drawings from when he was young. And you do see similarly that it totally comes to fruition.
Yeah.
The, you know, Jack Skellington, he had been sketching,
oh yeah,
you know, years, yeah, years prior. And
even in his, one of the things I really latched onto in that exhibit, and God damn it, like, they got to do something with Guillermo, like a Guillermo exhibit, like enter the world of, you know, Guillermo or whatever. One of the things I latched onto with the Tim Burton one is the list that he made in elementary school of all of his favorite movies. And they were all like these B movie, sci-fi, atomic age creature features. And I could just imagine a kid sitting there at his desk just writing down out of pure fandom all of his favorite monster movies.
Yeah.
And they all, you know, resonated through the rest of his works, you know. So good. So, so good. But Cronus is one of my favorite movies that Guillermo's ever done. You know, again, I love the characters. Ron Perlman is fantastic in this.
Speaking all kinds of Spanish. I don't know how.
Speaking Spanish and just in English as well, because they bounce back and forth. But there's these really quirky characteristics to him. You know, he's not playing the hardened badass, even though he is the badass in this movie. He's got a lot of vulnerability to him, a certain vanity. He carries around like these little cards that have noses on them because he wants to get a nose job. It's, mm-hmm. What the hell? Mm-hmm. All that kind of stuff.
So quirky.
It's great. It's great. And then Guillermo went off to do
Mimic.
Yeah.
And we talked about Mimic recently on the Bloodcast because I had just seen it for the first time.
Yeah. Yeah. Mimic. What were your thoughts on Mimic?
Well, I liked the themes. I liked the themes of the movie. I liked some of the characters, but I think it was very clear where the movie kind of got taken away,
mm-hmm.
where you know, the vision got lost. Obviously the rest of his work, Guillermo's work, speaks for itself. So he doesn't strike me as a filmmaker that loses sight. So clearly, and we know there's studio
tampering and stuff like
exactly.
that. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, so basically after Cronus, he was courted by the Hollywood system. Hollywood got its claws latched into him and they gave him Mimic. And in this case, it was Dimension, Bob and Harvey Weinstein. And I think that there's something great there. And I know that Lionsgate released a director's cut of the film. And I'm still not impressed by it. I mean, like, I don't know. It's a weird movie that I'll watch just to watch. But then about like three quarters of the way through, I'm unimpressed. And yeah. I'm kind of like, man, this movie really lost steam
yeah.
really fast.
Yeah.
I did not know this, but Robert Rodriguez did Second Unit, apparently.
Oh, that's cool.
Like, yeah, during this whole director's chair thing. They were actually showing scenes, at, you know, and Rodriguez is like, I did that. And Guillermo's like, I did that. And he's like, oh, you did that. And I was like, whoa, whoa, whoa. I didn't realize that. So the Dimension tapped into its reservoir of filmmakers just to kind of help him out. Mm-hmm. But yeah, Mimic is it's an interesting movie that goes against the grain of the usual summer horror movie fare that came out, because that movie came out in like late summer. It's got some interesting ideas. It kills kids. It's got cool creature design. But at the end of the day, I wasn't too impressed.
And I think also a lot of times, you know, horror directors take their first step out of independent film into studio film. Mm-hmm. Sometimes the results are, most of the time, I think, the results are not the greatest.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think it takes some getting used to, and I think it takes some finding your bearings and that kind of thing. But, I mean, it is a good project to attach Guillermo to.
Yeah.
I mean, it makes sense for him.
A movie about giant cockroaches that, like, basically wear human suits. But they're not even human suits. They're just using their claws and their wings, and they just look like human silhouettes. I mean, that's duh.
Yeah.
I remember reading about that in Fango, and I was like, wow, that sounds amazing. I can't wait to see it.
And one of the other things we talked about a couple of months ago when we were discussing this was I like the themes of, regeneration, giving, mm-hmm. and motherhood and, the circle of life and all of that kind of stuff. Yeah. And it's all very present there. I mean, I do think it fits pretty well within his canon. It's mm-hmm. just not as unique to him. It does feel studio-fied.
Yeah. It doesn't feel like, it doesn't feel entirely focused.
Right.
You know, you might say, because, you know, that studio tampering, I feel like if you had given him free reign, it would have been a hell of a lot weirder too.
Yeah, totally. Know? Yes. It's rather, yeah, generic.
A lot weird. A lot weirder.
Yep.
So then after that, you know, Guillermo went into director's jail for a bit. And he also kind of went through a little bit of a creative funk because he couldn't get anything off the ground. He was feeling pretty down on himself. And then Pedro Almodovar came along and was like, I want to produce your movie. And your next movie, whatever it may be. So Guillermo basically dusted off something he had called The Devil's Backbone. And from my understanding, he wrote it with someone else at one time, but then that got scrapped. So he had to start from scratch, but utilizing the same concept. So he told a film about this orphanage that's like way out in like this barren desert. And it's set during the Spanish Civil War. And it's basically a ghost story. It's kind of like not necessarily a whodunit. There's a lot of gears turning different subplots around because would you say it's a whodunit? Because it's not like the kids are trying to figure out the murder mystery of the kid, of the ghost kid.
Yeah.
There's just like, they just kind of happen upon a lot of these details.
I think it's more of a...
It's just a...
They're more in... my memory serves me correctly, aren't the kids just sort of like, they're scared at first, but then they realize they have to work together and it's kind of like fight or flight.
Yeah,
in a
because
way.
Basically there's other threats coming into play.
Yeah, exactly.
And it's not necessarily the ghost threat.
Right.
The ghost is just part of this whole thing. So basically you've got these kids who live in this orphanage, and then it's shepherded by like an older woman and an older man. And then there is the orphan who's all grown up. He's been there most of his life. But he's got his eyes fixed on the gold that is at the core of this orphanage. He's trying to get the key to get into the lock so he can get the gold and leave. But then these outside forces come into play and it just kind of escalates things. So Guillermo's playing with different subplots. And at the same time, these kids are kind of caught in the middle of it all. And they're also like, at the same time, they're also just kind of fleeing, running around going, oh my gosh, there's a ghost.
Yeah.
And the ghost has a backstory that ties to the older orphan and everything else. So this is my hands down my favorite Guillermo movie. I think it's a beautiful film. I think it looks, I love the color palette. Again, you've got these insect references. You've got a great ghost story. You've got some great great symbols at work. You know, I mean, the bomb, there's a bomb that sits in the middle of their playground that was dropped, but then it was defused and now it just sits there and they never pull it out. But it just says so much. Even though it was diffused, you feel like there's a ticking time bomb element at place in the plot. And it's just such a great, great movie. I love it.
Yeah, I love The Devil's Backbone, too. It's one that I saw in college. And then I don't know if I forgot that I had seen it or if I got it confused with something else. But then I like reordered it on Netflix and I rewatched it. And I was like, I've totally seen this. but I really like The Devil's Backbone, too. And I really love, I mean, you know, you guys, if you've listened to the show, you know that stuff with kids and stuff with families or whatever always kind of like gets under my skin a little more than I think other things. Mm-hmm. And so I like when he plays with these ideas. I like what he, you know, the shepherding that went into the orphanage. I like the, and I like the execution of Pan's Labyrinth. I think Pan's Labyrinth and Devil's Backbone, I think are friends.
Companion pieces.
Absolutely.
Oh, no, totally. When I interviewed Guillermo for Pan's when I was working at Fangoria, he was like, absolutely, this is definitely of that world,
yeah.
You know, and I think he's got, you know, I think he definitely has like one more in him to kind of like complete a trilogy.
Well,
so
I think it's also you've got the idea of, you know, like these children being, you know, it's like what they're threatened by in their fantasy world, mm-hmm. And this ghost, it's actually not the thing they need to be afraid of.
Right.
What they really need to be afraid of are the sinister,
the outside, the human elements. I mean, you know, the approaching armies, the renegades who are, you know, using the Spanish Civil War to benefit in terms of wealth, you know, all of these human threats,
mm-hmm.
you know, and again, I mean, like the thing that's on their side is this supernatural presence.
Exactly.
The supernatural is your friend.
Right.
And I love, love, love the depiction of the ghost. The ghost is seen with these kind of wispy embers coming around it, and they come with their own sound effects that squeak and squeal and stuff. And then it's this kid. He's got black eyes, but silver irises. He's got blood constantly flowing out of his head. And then when he walks through the daylight, you can see through his skin and see bone. And it's like, man, that is just, it's so great. But what I especially love is that Guillermo has accomplished with Devil's Backbone is that he delivered a film that I think in terms of character complexity, mm-hmm. it's his most successful film. You know, there's a lot of heartbreak involved. There's a lot of love. You know, there's this great love between the man and the older man and the older woman. And the older woman, like she lost her husband to the war, mm-hmm. or something like that. But this older man who's impotent can't give her what she needs. Mm-hmm. So she turns to one of the older orphan for sex. And it's like, there's all these great different layers to it. That's just really great that you don't get in, that you didn't get in Kronos. Kronos was very complex in terms of characters, but this is definitely a lot of shades and a lot of colors to it. Even more so than Pan's Labyrinth. I know that Pan's Labyrinth is the go-to, everybody's favorite, but we'll talk about that. We'll talk about that for sure.
Okay.
All right. So, after that, he did, hang on a second.
Blade
I'm losing
two,
track.
I
Blade 2. I always get the two mixed up. He did Blade 2 before he did Hellboy.
Yeah. So
because Blade 2 was his, I'll do this if you let me do Hellboy. So he did Blade 2 for New Line. Mike DeLuca approached him, and was like, listen, we want you to bring your stuff to this franchise. I'm a fan of the Blade trilogy.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that this one is definitely the best of the three. I just rewatched it last night.
Mm-hmm.
And listen, man, I mean, it's not all that deep, but it definitely shows that Guillermo can shoot action.
Mm-hmm.
He can work with a great stunt team and deliver some really great thrilling action set pieces, while at the same time maintaining a visual style that doesn't betray him, while at the same time delivering weirdness that resonates through his work. I mean, in this case, we have the Reapers who have these weird mouths that mm-hmm. open up and are very, like they're almost like, you know, in terms of species, they're almost like a brother type to the Strain monsters. And he can, you know, there's a sly sense of humor to Blade 2 that wasn't in the first one that mm-hmm. I really liked.
Yeah, I would agree with all of that. I mean, that's a, I don't.
It's just very teen fantasy fun,
yeah,
you know.
And there's nothing wrong with that.
Yeah.
And if you're gonna have to infuse new life into a sequel, mm-hmm. you know, you might as well revamp, make it your own, yeah. you know, and add something to it, but still maintain.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah.
It's kind of like giving the masses what they want, but slipping through like a lot of sly stuff in the back door. Kind of like, you're going to get this scene with this master vampire talking to Blade, but at the same time, I'm going to give you weird shit in jars in the background.
And
you're not going to wonder, you're not, you know, the normal moviegoer will go, oh, well, it's Blade, it's Wesley Snipes. But, you know, us genre fans are like, I wonder what's in those jars.
Yeah.
You know, what's in there?
I think that's the trick. I think that's the trick for any filmmaker when they're having to come to a property that isn't theirs, come to a second film in a franchise. They are, you know, they have to, and they want to put their stamp on it. Yeah. I mean, he's not a director for hire. That's the thing. I think Guillermo, his personality is in everything that he touches.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I agree with you. I think he maintains his authenticity in this one while still keeping with the series.
He succeeded.
Totally.
Where some filmmakers don't. Some filmmakers lose their voice in doing big franchise stuff like this.
Or they overcompensate the other way and it doesn't fit in with the rest of the franchise.
Yeah, exactly. This definitely fits in with the franchise. I feel like he embraced the European vibe of it because they shot overseas. They shot in like Romania or something. So they were just like, all right, this takes place in Europe. And I think that that's such a big benefit because sometimes we see movies and we're like, that's not New York. Mm-hmm. That's not US. What are you doing? Mm-hmm. You know, relocating Blade's adventures to Europe. I mean, I think definitely was a huge benefit because it gave a great visual palette. I love the score by Marco Beltrami. The title sequence is absolutely fucking amazing. And Walking Dead fans, I tweeted about this last night. Norman Reedus is in this film. He plays Scud, which is Blade's right-hand man after Whistler goes. Well, Whistler disappears for a bit, but comes back. But yeah, it's young Norman Reedus.
There you go.
Tussling with Kris Kristofferson, which is pretty fucking great. And also, I just want to also mention the choreography, the fighting choreography. Watching this, I mean, like the film only came out in what, 2002, a little over 10 years ago. And you could see such a distinctive change and evolution in terms of how action is shot between then and today. Because Guillermo doesn't mind letting the camera linger and, you know, all this hand-to-hand combat stuff. It just flows so wonderfully and it's just so, you could feel the impact of it as opposed to a filmmaker today who will just be cut, 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 mm-hmm. cut. And you're like, wait a minute, I'm not getting a sense of any of this.
Well,
you know, what's happening?
I also think Guillermo is a fanboy.
Yeah.
So it's like he knows what he wants to see, what he wanted to see when he was a kid, when he was watching whomever fight vampires or do whatever it was. It was like, let me see it.
Yeah.
And so I would wager that he probably consciously made that decision.
Yeah, but Blade 2, dug it. Hellboy.
Do
you like Hellboy?
I liked it. You know, so here's the funny thing. When I came back from Cannes in 2006, I like ordered every Guillermo del Toro movie I could on Netflix. So I watched a lot of these things a long time ago. Hellboy I revisited and I honestly didn't remember any of it. So I rewatched it though yesterday morning and you know, I noticed the themes that are present in the rest of his work, but I also noticed that I feel like Hellboy, especially rewatching it in the context of Guardians having just come out, is just so ahead of its time in terms of taking a property, and granted it's a good fit. I think the Hellboy comics are a good fit for Guillermo, but I think that it was really cool, like seeing this quirky superhero universe. And keep in mind, this is even before Iron Man. Iron Man was what, 2008?
Yeah.
If I'm not mistaken, I'm pretty sure because I was in college graduating. So I was really kind of like, wow, this totally set the stage for all of these weird Marvel movies that we're now starting to see. And it really, to me, was not the first time, but I think it was a great example of matching the right director to the right project. Right. Meaning, you know, know, now that we have people like James Gunn, you know, directing Guardians, or you have Kenneth Branagh doing Thor, it's like these things make sense to me.
Yeah.
And so I think that they really tapped into something before, way ahead of the curve.
Yeah, absolutely. And also, I mean, like, talk about a property, you know, like you said, speaking to a little bit of that, Guillermo wanted to do Hellboy for years and years, and somebody had actually allowed him to do it. And they were like, but you can't have Ron Perlman. He's like, it doesn't happen. Mm-hmm. You know, I want Ron Perlman. As a fan of both the comic book and the films, I feel like they act separately, like the Marvel Cinematic Universe certainly does. You know, might not stay entirely true to the comic books. I feel like the core and the heart of the Hellboy films certainly pick up and are inspired by the comics, even if the comics are maybe a little bit more gothic and baroque than what Guillermo brought to the table. You know, Guillermo, you know, Mike Mignola's art focuses on weird close-ups of gargoyle faces and statues and stuff like that, and are certainly colorful, but not as colorful as what Guillermo brings to the table.
And just to interject real fast is that I'm not as familiar with the comics as you are, but there was a point seeing how dark and twisted and grim Guillermo has gotten, like, in his mainstream fare, in terms of not being afraid to show us these images that are haunting and terrifying. I could notice, and I did notice when I was rewatching the movie yesterday, like, wow, this is rather tame in a way.
Oh, yeah.
You know,
yeah.
And so I could totally see what you're saying. Like, it's not all as the movies, you know, without even knowing it very much at all about the books, I can totally see exactly what you're saying.
Yeah, and I think this is more kid stuff.
Right.
You know,
it's
more kid stuff and more family accessible. And I forgot who told me. There was somebody on the inside who told me that, like, when they were running numbers on, you know, who comes out for these films, there is a large contingent of just families and kids. They love Hellboy. And it blows my mind that no one right now wants to tap into that and give us the final chapter in this trilogy. I mean, like, the second film lays the groundwork for something in part three. And it's like, why isn't anybody doing
this?
Well,
I think Guillermo talking about it now, you know, being outspoken about saying, I would do this anytime.
Yeah.
And the fact that Weirdo Guardians just made a gazillion dollars.
Yeah.
I wanted to agree with you also that when I was watching this movie yesterday, I was like, man, because this came out in what, 2004?
Yep.
So I was graduating high school.
Okay.
If this had come out when I was 12,
mm-hmm.
I would have been the biggest Hellboy fan you have ever seen. Like, just the goofy one-liners, the monsters, the demons, the creatures.
Lovecraftian stuff. I mean, this
so
is Guillermo.
Lovecraftian.
Yeah, I mean, Mike Mignola was drawn, you know, he draws off the Lovecraft's weirdness and stuff. You know, this is, I think, I would want to say that this is kind of like the first film that Guillermo did that's just full bore Lovecraft.
Yeah.
It's like, I'm going to give you a giant monster with tons of tentacles.
Yep.
Let's just see how this flies.
Here's my demo reel.
Yeah.
Here's my reel, guys. Please let me do this. But yeah, I agree with you 100%. If I were a kid, and this is something, by the way, my dad would have taken me to.
Yeah.
My dad would have totally seen this and been like, let's go. Mm-hmm. I will take you on Saturday afternoon and we'll get Burger King after.
Yeah.
So
after Hellboy, Guillermo reined it in a little bit and he went back and did something a little bit more personal. I mean, like, you know, for a while, I had the belief that Guillermo did one of these, like, one for them, one for me kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But that doesn't hold water anymore because everything is for him. Everything, regardless of what the outcome might be and regardless of, you know, who it might be for, Guillermo is on everything in these movies that we're talking about. And everything is for him. And he's going to do everything for him. You know, and if somebody, you know, an outside influence comes into play, he still fights that and he still does his thing. So saying that doesn't hold water anymore. So from Hellboy, he went on to do something a little bit smaller and a little bit more personal, Pan's Labyrinth, which is a beautiful film. I mean, I keep saying beautiful because that's the best word to describe this guy's work. And Pan's Labyrinth is great. It's just a great movie. Like I said, I prefer the mystery and the sense of the unknown of Devil's Backbone, Pan's Labyrinth is more of a, if like Devil's Backbone was kind of like about kids being introduced to the violence that men do, this like takes it up one more notch.
Right.
One more notch. Yeah. I mean, like a guy gets his face beaten by a bottle in this film. But it's a gorgeous movie. I love The Fallen. I love everything about it. The Pale Man's great. I rewatched it before we came over. And again, I feel it holds up, but it's not like something I'm going to reach to. And I think it's just weird to say, I mean, because it is an accomplished movie, but it's just not something that falls within like what I want to put on, like, a, you know, on a Saturday night.
Yeah, it's funny. I'm the complete opposite.
Yeah.
I've watched this movie recently. I found myself anytime I'm in this house sitting and it's always on Sundance. It's either Sundance or IFC, but it's always on television. And every time it's on, I stop and watch it.
Yeah.
Every time it's on, I put it on. And all those emotions and feelings that you were describing with Devil's Backbone, I feel for Pan's Labyrinth. But perhaps it's gendered. I mean, not saying exclusively, obviously, but perhaps it's, you know, the fact that there's certain themes that are speaking more to me in Pan's Labyrinth, and not just because it's a fairy tale, because like you said, it's a brutal, movie.
Yeah.
The captain getting his face sliced open and then having to stitch it back together is amazing.
It's definitely a female-driven film.
I mean,
it's basically, he's pulling, a lot of things from previous films that he just touched on, whether it's the dance instructor from Kronos, whether it is the older woman with the one leg in Devil's Backbone, who literally, there's one moment where she's like, I'm the one who's going to be strong here, you know, amongst all of these men.
Yeah.
You know, even Liz from Hellboy, you know, it's like, I feel like he filtered all of that female strength into Pan's Labyrinth.
Yeah. And great characters too. Like, I love Mercedes, the woman who is kind of the attendant. Is wonderful. Yeah. Her performance is great. I love the fact that in the genre film, we get the inner workings of the resistance. Mm-hmm. See, this is another reason why Pan's Labyrinth speaks to me is because I think it's a very political movie.
Yeah.
And it came out in a time in 2006 when war was happening on the global scale, definitely in Western, in Western society. And so I think that it just is a perfect, it was right place, right time. And I love the idea that a filmmaker can blend something so fantastical, because, you know, violence and horror, we know, can serve as, you know, they can represent a lot of things across the board. But to actually weave a fairy tale, a proper true fairy tale and magic and fantasy into this harsh reality and brutal situation, I think that is even more of a challenge.
Yeah.
And so the fact that he was able to do that and find this and create this story that works so perfectly, this one is my favorite. This is my favorite Guillermo del Toro movie.
Yeah, I embrace it because of how well produced it is. Mm-hmm. It's kind of like, somebody finally gave him the money and the budget and everything he wanted to accomplish, everything that's in his head, because it's all up there. I mean, that whole feast that the Pale Man puts on, it's just, wow, man. I mean, it's full of warmth and it's majestic. Everything about this film is majestic when it comes to the fairy tale end of things. In reality, it's grimy and gritty and
dirty, dirt everywhere.
Yeah, and just violent. I kind of feel like Devil's Backbone, it's centralized into this like little orphanage out in this like kind of desert environment. I feel like somewhere it's like out in the outskirts, past those mountains, Pan's Labyrinth is happening somewhere.
Well, and that's,
even if a chronology doesn't tie up.
Well, that's the other part of the fairy tale too that I think is so cool, is that as most of us know, or a lot of people know, the actual Grimm's fairy tales, the actual fairy tales are nasty and brutal and horrifying. And so I really like that Guillermo del Toro made an R-rated fairy tale.
Yeah.
And not only that, he tricked everybody into watching it.
Yeah.
You know, this wasn't a thing that flew under the radar. This was a thing that people worldwide embraced and got wrapped up in, which to me is another huge feat and accomplishment that not a lot of people can do.
Yeah.
The fact that he made an R-rated fairy tale in Spanish and it won Oscars, and, you know, I don't know, and people saw it,
yeah,
is a huge accomplishment.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And you could definitely just see, I mean, like, we can touch on his growth as a filmmaker. He's refining his taste and refining his vision and refining everything. And here, while there's a certain, there's certain complexity to the characters, I don't think it's, maybe if Devil's Backbone's a little bit scattered all over the place, there's so many things happening. He, in a very focused fashion, hones in specifically on the girl.
Yep.
She's our lead, you know, whereas Devil's Backbone, you don't know who the lead is specifically. Mm-hmm. It's an ensemble cast.
Yeah.
Devil's Backbone, I mean, what Pan's Labyrinth is great at is focusing on this little girl and little girl only.
Yeah.
And then we care about the other characters going out, revolving all around her, but she is the main piece.
Right.
You know?
Yep.
But yeah, Pan's Labyrinth is very good. I'm definitely, I just want to say I'm not poo-pooing the movie at all. Yeah. I love it. I just feel like, you know, Devil's Backbone's more preferred. And I think it was funny. I read somewhere or someplace, Guillermo actually said, he's like, depending on the week, he's like, it's either Pan's Labyrinth or Devil's Backbone. I don't even know.
Because they're brother and sister. Yeah, I mean, come on. It really, that's like really choosing your children.
Sophie's Choice.
Yeah, I mean, how do you choose? You know.
So Pan's Labyrinth came out in 2006. A couple years later, Hellboy 2, The Golden Army hits.
Now, I'm going to let you take this one because I have seen this movie. Yeah. But again, it was in 2006. And I couldn't get it in time to rewatch. So
well, Hellboy 2, The Golden Army, you know, it's again, it's a nice piece. It's an improvement over Hellboy, mm-hmm. where Hellboy has its flaws. I feel this was this is a much better effort. To me, this is tantamount to the awe and wonder that Ray Harryhausen films gave you. Seventh Voyage of Sinbad, Jason and the Argonauts. This is Hellboy going on a grand journey against this, you know, this scorned prince and all of the monsters that come at play into play and all the stuff. It's just, I remember watching it with my jaw on the floor going, oh my God, there's so many monsters and they're practical and they're amazing. I love you all. It's kid stuff and it's family stuff, but it's so great. I mean, this is Guillermo doing family fun, you know, adventure, and Hellboy is his Indiana Jones, you know, I mean, like that's basically what this is. And again, Guillermo brings some really great stuff into this. I mean, the movie opens with teenage Hellboy drawing from one of the best fucking Hellboy strips ever. There's a great, like, I don't know, I think it's like a one pager Hellboy comic strip, and it's Hellboy eating pancakes, but it's baby Hellboy. And like, you learn why Hellboy loves pancakes so much. And it's the most adorable fucking thing ever. So he draws from that, and gives us a, you know, teenage Hellboy. And this is how the film opens. And basically John Hurt is laying the backstory about this golden army. And he tells it, it's CGI, but he does it like they're puppets. The backstory is all told with puppets. And I'm like, what the fuck? What made him just go, oh yeah, I want to do this with puppets. You know, it's like, wow, that's amazing. I mean, nobody else would have done that. They would have just given you a straight backstory with live action characters. Again, I think the puppets were done by CGI, but still, like, the impression was that they were done by puppets. But it's just it's big and it's silly and it's fun. But it's very thoughtful because at its core, Hellboy 2 is kind of this rumination on how we're just fucking up the earth. There's a great moment where, I forgot what kind of god rises up in the middle of a city street, but it's just vines and a giant plant. And you know, Hellboy doesn't want to kill this thing, but he has to, because this thing is going to destroy people, but he has to take it down. It's an elemental. And you know, I mean, it's an elemental that has been around for as long as the earth has been around, and its death is very symbolic. You know, it's kind of like this, we're messing things up. And even the prince himself, he is a representation of old earth and wanting to reclaim, you know, things that were good about the planet and all this other stuff. So it was just a really interesting thing at play in the movie, that maybe not many people looked at. They probably just were like, yeah, big fun, you know, spectacle. But a Hellboy 2, man. I mean, like, it's, you know, again, Hellboy, Guillermo has given you a sequel that's smarter than the average bear. Mm-hmm. You know, I think that Hellboy 2 is a significant improvement over Hellboy 1, just like Blade 2 is an improvement over Blade.
I have a question.
Yes.
Because next we jump from Hellboy 2, The Golden Army, to Pacific Rim. So we've got 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I just wanted to ask you, your thoughts on if Guillermo had done The Hobbit. What do you think?
No, I don't think so? I was
so?
Not happy when he jumped on The Hobbit.
Really? Why?
Because I felt like it's more of just not entitlement. I felt like The Hobbit and everything that implied was owned creatively and visually by Peter Jackson. Peter Jackson laid the groundwork for how these films should be.
Yes.
And he knew better. I mean, listen, this isn't disputing Guillermo doesn't know shit about The Hobbit, because the guy went down to New Zealand for like 3 or 2 years of his life and developed this shit. I think I was down in Australia and they were producing Don't Be Afraid of the Dark. That's why we were there. And Guillermo was like, hey, I just came over. And he's like, get this. He's like, I was sitting in a screening room and down in New Zealand, and Spielberg walked in and Peter Jackson walked in, and I was like, holy shit.
Oh,
so
wow.
I was like, imagine this.
Wow.
Jackson, Del Toro, Spielberg, because Spielberg was doing Tintin at the time.
Yeah.
So they were using the same facility. So they were all hanging out in this one facility, all being creative.
Wow.
Like, I could just imagine this big creative explosion just happening. But I feel like Jackson, you know, that's his arena. And I felt like Del Toro putting his stamp on it was a waste of his efforts, because I'd rather see him give us another Pan's Labyrinth, or rather see him do another Hellboy, or rather see him do anything other than something that was kind of already established.
Mm, I was the opposite.
Yeah?
I really wanted him to do it, because as much as I enjoy big scope fantasy and that kind of thing, which I do, I have never been able to get into the Lord of the Rings movies. Ever.
Yeah.
I've tried.
Yeah. Well, I think we're on the same level. Like, fantasy is, I mean, I'm not really into Lord of the Rings fantasy.
You know, it's weird, too. I still can't for the life of me figure out why I love Neverending Story, Labyrinth, Willow, all those kinds of things. And I cannot get into Lord of the Rings. And I don't know why. But that being said, when I heard Guillermo del Toro was going to still live in the same universe, right? Because it's not like he was making one of the Lord of the Rings movies. It was like, no, he's going to do The Hobbit. So it's in the neighborhood, but it's different.
Yep.
I thought that was cool. Mm-hmm. I was like, oh, I want to see this. I want to see another filmmaker who is quirky and has their own personality. I mean, in a lot of ways, I think, you know, Peter Jackson and Guillermo del Toro, you know, as I imagine them, could be like, you know, like cut from the same cloth in a lot of ways as directors and filmmakers. So I was intrigued by the opportunity to see a new light shed on it and to see some of those Guillermo del Toro isms applied to a universe that didn't quite work for me because I thought, well, maybe this could now
make
work
a little bit
for
more
me.
Palatable for you.
Yes.
Yeah.
And so I was intrigued, and I thought it was very disappointing when, you know, it didn't quite happen, and I couldn't imagine having put all of that work in and just kind of having it taken away.
Idea. Yeah. I have no idea. Well, I didn't follow it too closely because, like, I just kind of tuned out on the Hobbit news. I really wanted to see Guillermo, you know, like I said, put his efforts elsewhere. And he was, because he was spreading. I mean, we could talk a little bit about this. Some of his producing efforts.
Yeah.
You know, he's done a lot of stuff. I mean, he oversaw the Hellboy animated movies and stuff like that. But then he also was an exec producer on Splice and Julia's Eyes, which I've never seen. Don't Be Afraid of the Dark.
We need to talk about Don't Be Afraid of the Dark.
Rise of the Guardians. Yeah. Mama.
I like Mama. Yeah. I watched it again the other day. You know what? Still like Mama.
Still on HBO Go, man.
Still like it. Still. And you know what? Think it's better than when I saw it in the theater. I think it's getting better.
All right.
Maybe it's wearing me down.
I'll have to give it a shot.
No, don't. You're going to hate it.
Well, it's interesting. I was, you know, I know that Del Toro was attached to Splice, and he was an executive producer, but he clarified on that director's chair that that was an instance where he was like, I stayed hands off and let Vincenzo Natale do his thing. He said, usually I let the filmmaker do their thing, but I also, you know, kind of have a little say and this and that. He's like, that was a one instance. So I could see that, because I can't see anything.
I can't either.
I can't see anything Del Toro in Splice. It's all Vincenzo.
I just watched Splice for the first time months ago. And to read that in preparation for this, I was like, really?
Yeah.
Because he doesn't seem like the type of guy. And correct me if I'm wrong. I mean, he is attached to everything, it feels. But he doesn't feel to me when it says that Guillermo del Toro produced it, mm-hmm. it feels like you can find him there.
Yeah.
You can see him. It's kind of like when I was talking to Alex Aja about Horns, and we talked about directing versus producing for him. And he was like, I want to be very clear.
Yeah.
When I produce a project, I'm there.
Yeah.
I'm in this.
Right.
And I don't want to just slap my name on something and say, so-and-so presents. And I feel like with Guillermo, when you look at The Orphanage, when you look at Mama, when you look at Don't Be Afraid of the Dark, I think he's very much, yeah. I feel him there, you
yep.
know?
Yep. Yeah.
But
I mean, especially with, yeah, Don't Be Afraid of the Dark. I mean, like, I was down there and he was, you know, he was on set. I mean, he bounced back and
yeah.
forth. And I have a feeling that he directed some moments.
You think so?
No.
Here's my question. What happened on Don't Be Afraid of the Dark? Do you think? Because I know he wrote the script.
He did.
And he was so adamant about talking about the original and how the original TV movie was like such a, he remembered yeah. it.
This was a script that he did with Matthew Robbins. Matthew Robbins is one of his collaborators on a few scripts. Like they wrote Mimic together. They did Crimson Peak, the upcoming Crimson Peak. Mm-hmm. Don't Be Afraid of the Dark was a script that they had done a while ago. It was kind of sitting around. They pulled in a short filmmaker, Troy Nixie, who's got a great vision. However, I mean, so many years have passed. My understanding of it is Troy got overwhelmed mm. on that production. Guillermo had to come in and help out a little bit
mm.
or a lot more.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what the percentage is. I don't think that Don't Be Afraid of the Dark is a terrible film.
Oh.
I think it's okay. I feel like it's a little bit sluggish. It kind of doesn't know where it's going.
Yeah.
But whenever those creatures are on screen,
I love the creatures.
I love the creatures.
I
wish those
them.
Creatures could just get utilized for another movie.
Have like, their own movie.
Yeah. Give them like take the computer program that created those little buggers and put them in a different movie altogether.
A better movie.
Yeah. I mean, there's some good moments at work. Little girl in the bathtub when they start attacking. You know, mm-hmm. when they're in the shower, like
yep.
I'm in the shower curtains
yep,
and stuff yep. like that. But it doesn't really, like I said, it's not a very focused effort in spite of great production design, cool creatures.
Yeah, that one was just such a mess
yeah.
as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah.
I could not tell. That was actually the first time I've ever been disappointed by Guillermo del Toro's name.
Yeah.
I was like really excited. I even ordered the Kim Darby movie and watched it
yeah.
and was like, okay, I'm in.
Yeah,
and then
yeah.
I showed up like opening night. And I was like, what the fuck is this?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I thought it was, you know what it was too? Because we all know Guy Pearce is a good actor.
Yeah.
That's not for
we've sung his praises here.
Right. But some of the acting in that movie was just
yeah.
like a
Doesn't
joke.
Doesn't he play like an architect or something like that?
All I remember from Guy Pearce being Shenanigans is at one point his daughter comes up from the basement and goes, Dad, I found human teeth in the basement. And he's like, oh, well, don't go down there anymore. And I was like, I'm sorry. Like, yeah. You know, pump the brakes here. What?
I wonder if this was a script that just didn't get enough, if it didn't get the attention that it needed when it needed to be polished. Like Guillermo and Matthew Robbins were like, here's a script. Here you go. Let's
done.
Put it, do your thing, you know?
Maybe.
And then, you know, maybe Troy Nixie was like, okay, cool. You know, I don't want to mess with this. Oof. So
I don't know, but that's the biggest disappointment I've ever had from
yeah.
a Guillermo del Toro production. But I love The Orphanage. I want more of The Orphanage.
Oh yeah. The Orphanage.
I want
yeah,
them
yeah,
to
yeah.
remake it.
Yeah.
Oh. I love that movie. No, I mean, remake it in a good way,
oh.
like an American version,
oh, okay.
like I don't care. I want more.
Yeah.
I want another one.
Okay.
And I love the original. It's not like I'm having a problem with the original. And by the way, with Mama, did you notice that the little girl is the same little girl in The Strain?
The Strain, huh?
I saw her like in the yeah. pilot, and I was like, Lily!
Yeah,
and
yeah.
I was so
little
excited.
Little girl in the bathtub with a long tongue.
Oh my God, I love her.
Yeah, she was a sweetheart.
Victoria, Mama.
I will hand it to Mama. Those little kids are pretty cute.
They're great. They're
cute
so
kids.
Good.
Cute kids.
Oh, I love it.
I never saw Puss in Boots, Kung Fu Panda 2, or Rise of the Guardians.
I have seen Kung Fu Panda 2. It is a delight. I love Kung Fu Panda.
I wonder how he got involved in all of that.
DreamWorks.
You know?
DreamWorks Animation. I think he has a bigger deal with them.
Okay.
I know that the one, Guardians, what was it called?
Rise of the Guardians.
Rise of the Guardians. Yeah, that one did not do very well.
No.
And I know he was adamant. He was
no.
vocal about being very disappointed,
yeah.
Which is too bad. And then what was the other one?
Puss in Boots.
Oh, Puss in Boots. That kind of makes perfect sense, doesn't it? Doesn't it? I think it does. I think it does.
Oh, and, man.
But I can tell you, and I know we've kind of skipped over something. We'll go back. But yeah. Like I said a couple of weeks ago, the stuff I've seen from Book of Life is so good.
Yeah, no, I'm curious.
I think it's
no,
so good. And I think it feels, it's got that energy and that pizzazz that Guillermo has, but it's not childish.
Okay.
It doesn't feel childish. And very dark. I mean, clearly we're dealing with the underworld. Yeah. We're dealing with demons and spirits and all of these things, and gorgeous to look at. Cool. Oh my God. I'm so excited for both.
Nice. Nice.
Anyway, let's go back to Pacific Rim.
Pacific Rim.
We've talked about that.
Yeah, we've talked about it. I mean, like, listen, Pacific Rim is, I'll say that Pacific Rim is a movie that grows on me more and more each time, because I remember the first time I saw it at the Warner Brothers screening room last summer, I was kind of like, oh, okay, cool. And I was like, I'm not exactly being fanboyish about this movie, but I do like it. And then I saw it on IMAX and I was like, wow, this is really rad. This is big and cool and fun. And then it hit HBO Go and I was like, all right, I'm going to put this on. And then I sat there and, like the Avengers, I've discovered this now. If the Avengers or Pacific Rim are on any goddamn network now, I sit there and watch the whole thing. Yeah. Like, I sit there, I'm like, oh, wherever, at whatever point I'm at, I'm going to watch this whole thing now.
Yeah.
And it's fun. And I like Pacific Rim 2. I love Pacific Rim. I'm very excited for Pacific Rim 2 now.
Me too. Yeah. And also, you know, just to piggyback on that with the idea of, oh my God, I lost my train of thought. Pacific Rim, what were we talking about? How it's awesome and it grows up. Oh, the action. So similarly to me, and perhaps others might argue, maybe my eyeballs didn't catch it, but I really felt like when we were talking earlier about the Blade choreography, and you know, it's like, we're just going to let them fight. We're just going to let all of it go out. To me, I really thought that for a huge action blockbuster that could have been Transformers with all the quick cuts and all that stuff, I feel like Pacific Rim really lets you see what's going on.
Oh yeah. Well, because it has no choice. I mean, the thing is that he is the anti-Michael Bay. Michael Bay is dealing with giant Transformers and he is insistent on getting the camera as close as humanly fucking possible to a Transformer's arm bashing into something. Pull back, man. I want to see everything.
I want to see the Transformer.
I want to see the damn Transformer. And Guillermo's wise enough to go, you know what? This camera is going to be perched on a rooftop and you're just going to see the Jaeger walking through the streets.
I totally dug that. And the other thing I noticed while I was thinking about Pacific Rim again the other day was that the reason, and I made this point actually before, not here, somewhere else, but you know, I love 90s action movies.
Yeah.
I love action movies in general. But for me, like, the 80s action movies, just a little too aggro. It's a little too sweaty and like whatever. I love Predator, though. I do love Predator. But anyway, with the, and then the 2000s action movies and action movies we have now, I like your socks. Ryan has cool socks on. I just saw. They're awesome.
Shout out to my socks.
They're great socks. So anyway, though, with the aughts and the movies that we're getting now, it is. It's that quick cut, blah, blah, blah. Can't see anything. 90s action movie has a bit of, you know, it's like, it's about a family and it's about the dad having to do something because the mom's mad at him or he's got a kid or whatever the case may be. And it's got all the one-liners and it's fun, right? It's the epitome, I think, of a fun action movie. That is what Pacific Rim is to me. I think that Pacific Rim is the last 90s action movie. It is, you know, if Top Gun and Independence Day had a baby, to me, that's Pacific Rim.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And I think that that is sort of present in all of Guillermo's action-ish movies, is fun. You're allowed to have fun when you're watching them.
It gives you all the broad strokes of a character. Broad characterizations, but just enough heart for you to latch on to who they are.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, like, you've got, Charlie Hunnam's character, man who lost his brother, getting pulled back into the war. That's all you need to know.
Yeah.
I mean, like, what's he got to lose? Nothing. But, you know, obviously he's like trying to regain like whatever he lost when his brother got pulled out of the Jaeger suit. What do you call it?
I don't know.
Cockpit. There you go. I'm finding the words today. And then you've got the girl.
Mako,
you know, and all she wants to do is get in there and do her thing. It's like, you know, these very big, broad characterizations, but like I said, just enough, you know, heartfelt detail for you to like latch on. we got that in the '80s. You know, we were talking about these like family movies. Or these
I think in the '90s you get more of that.
Well, I feel like that originated in the '80s, but then they got fine tuned and maybe not necessarily refined, but fine tuned. And they directors really latched onto that into that in the '90s. Yeah. That's why we got films like Jurassic Park and Independence Day and, you know, all that kind of stuff. But yeah, I completely agree. I mean, this is definitely is a film of a certain time and, but just, gussied up for now.
And I'm glad that it's getting a second life because, you know, we talked about this last year when it came out and the numbers and all of that. And it's just, you know, a drag. I think it was a poor marketing, to be honest with you.
Yeah.
But regardless, I'm glad that.
Dude, poor marketing from the studio that doesn't even know what they want to call Edge of Tomorrow.
Have
you been following that nonsense?
What?
That basically Warner Brothers put out. Warner Brothers, that's Edge of Tomorrow, yeah?
Yeah.
They put out Edge of Tomorrow?
And Legendary.
So Edge of Tomorrow, the Tom Cruise movie that came out this year, they put it out and they sent out screener or final product of the DVDs and Blu-rays. And the title on the box says Live, Die, Repeat. And then
that's the original title.
And then, no, the original title was All You Need Is Kill.
Okay.
And then it turned into Edge of
Live,
Tomorrow.
Live, Die, Repeat is the tagline.
That's the tagline. Oh. So they've adopted the tagline as the official title because even, like it says, Live, Die, Repeat on the cover. And then in like little letters, it says Edge of Tomorrow. And on the spine, it says Live, Die, Repeat, Edge of Tomorrow. And it's like, holy crap, you guys don't even know, like even to the film's dying day on like DVD and Blu-ray, you still don't know what to do with this thing. Ugh, whatever, man.
I can't speak to any of, no comment.
So weird.
But that's shenanigans.
Yeah. But yeah, Pacific Rim, man. I it's growing up. It's grown on me. I really love the film. I think it's great. The Strain.
Yes.
This is Guillermo doing televised horror. And talk about something that definitely feels like it's hailing from the 90s. I feel
like someone who was written, I feel, and they like, yeah. Because you know the legend of how this all came to be and the idea that they pitched it around as a TV show and nobody wanted it. And they're like, fine, we'll go write a book. Yeah. And then The Walking Dead hits, and now everybody needs genre on TV. And so now they're like, oh, did you want this TV show that we invented like 10 years ago that you made us write as a book because you guys are dumb? And so it was like literally full circle, which I think I love that story.
Yeah, it's kind of like Zombieland. Yeah. Zombieland began as a television show, and then they turned it into a film, and then it turned into a piece of shit TV pilot.
And then who knows?
But yeah, with the Strain, it's Guillermo exploring the nature of the vampire species, Strigoi, the legend of the Strigoi, and you know, utilizing some of the old concept art that he had for Blade 2 and also Kronos. It's all being filtered into this show, and I don't know. I mean, like I was just on What the Flick yesterday talking about it, and you know, listen, I mean, it's a show. You take the good with the bad, man, but overall. It's fucking entertaining. It's an entertaining show. I'm entertained.
I want to say two things. The first one is I'm two episodes in.
Okay.
Yeah, so I'm two episodes in. I mean, I started reading the first novel a while ago, and I'm already, unless my memory is wrong, which is entirely possible, I'm already noticing differences. Like, they're already breaking with the novel, so whatever. Yeah. But
I got like 30 pages into the novel, and I was like, this is written weird, and I closed it. And I was like, I'm done. I didn't like the writing.
Persevere. So, but what I wanted to say is that, well, I wanted to ask you a question, but I also had, my brain, where is my brain? These are my confessions. Do you feel like the pilot doesn't really feel Guillermo-y? I mean, I feel like it feels less like him than, say, episode 2, the second episode. Right? But he did not direct the second episode. Yeah. I know.
I feel like it looks like a Guillermo movie.
Yeah.
It definitely looks like a Guillermo movie.
I don't feel like there's personality.
I feel like this is Mimic era Guillermo. Mimic era Guillermo. That. And that stays true through the whole, up to like episode 6 and 7. So,
well, yeah. I like when he does the pointing in the second, when he's like, the old man is in jail and he's like just pointing through the glass.
You mean
like,
the character that John Hurt was supposed to play?
Yes, basically, yes.
And he was supposed to be that character. And then he bowed out. I think it might have been too much. Probably. I mean, John Hurt's like,
he's
what,
a
man?
Million years old.
Yeah. Definitely, definitely much, much older.
The other thing I wanted to say is that I wrote up the unofficial news that it was renewed because the Toronto newspaper spilled the beans, which was hilarious. I loved that, that everybody, like, I'm sourcing this or this story, and everyone keeps linking back to this teeny tiny little Toronto, like, outlet.
Global,
and
I'm
like,
Global News.
Yeah, and I'm like, really? That article was one of the most retweeted and favorited articles that I have written for Nerdist.
Yeah, people are watching it. People are liking it.
They are. And, you know, but then you get exactly that. It's kind of like under the dome syndrome a little. Like this idea of like, we're watching it. We don't really know if we like it, but we're watching it.
Yeah.
Is it? I mean, am I wrong?
No, I completely agree. Listen, man, like this is the thing with television. There's an audience for everything now.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe not for canceled NBC shows, but there's an audience for like a lot of these dramas. And
I think on cable especially.
Yeah. I mean, like, listen, if you're weird and you've got something new to offer, then why not, man?
There you go.
You know what? Under the Dome, speaking of just how like off book Under the Dome is going, you know, I read the book. I love the book. But like I saw some tweet about one of the main characters and their father, and I was like, that character didn't have a father mentioned anywhere in the fucking novel. Listen. Redo Under the Dome.
Listen.
Cancel it on CBS.
Start over.
Give it to Showtime and give me like a miniseries, man. What the?
Well, CBS owns Showtime.
Yeah.
So they should just switch networks.
Idiots.
Listen. My first Bloodcast assignment was 2 episodes of Under the Dome. They got no more from me.
Oh, sorry.
That was, yeah, you didn't even watch them.
I did. Yeah.
Eventually.
Yeah.
You didn't watch them for the show,
Such
I remember.
Such garbage, man.
It is awful.
Yeah, but The Strain, I'm glad it's going to get new life because, I mean, like I said, I think that there's just a purpose for it everywhere. You know, there's just it sates a need that us horror fans want on television. Listen, I watched I didn't get to mention this last week, I watched, there's a great autopsy sequence that's coming up on The Strain, not spoilers. And I watched it. And again, that's something that Guillermo has fun with, his autopsy moments, because there's a great autopsy sequence in Blade 2 as well. But I was watching this autopsy scene, and you know, I mean, like they got these long tongue things. Mm-hmm. There's literally a moment where Corey Stoll is pulling one of these tongues and it keeps going and going and going. And finally he's like halfway across the room and it snaps. And and I look over my shoulder and this woman on the plane with me is like giving me this face. Like, what the fuck?
What are you watching?
And on top of the fact that they are doing this to the pilot of the character, the pilot.
Sure.
It was just pretty funny. Cause like moments ago you'd seen him in like a pilot outfit. Terrible, terrible fun stuff. Watch it on a plane, please. But yeah, I mean, listen, I mean, like, I just have fun with
well,
the show.
It's, No.
I mean, that's it.
I was just going to say that I think there's a place for fun and slight camp and a little goofiness.
And it's embracing it.
And that's the thing, because like with Walking Dead is always so serious and other... And other genre ventures, even if they are quality, like Hannibal is very heavy.
Oh, yes.
And
so
intense.
Heavy.
So it's kind of...
Let me clarify my and then
Yeah.
Is Walking Dead fucking like liven up a little bit and Hannibal, so good.
I know.
So hot right now.
So hot.
Hannibal.
Hannibal. Hannibal. But yeah, so I think it's good that the Strain can live in a world where The Walking Dead and Hannibal.
Did you see that Sci-Fi Channel is doing their own like zombie television series now?
No.
It's called like Z Nation or something.
Oh, I have heard of this, but not really. I'm so confused by it.
Yeah, I'm confused too. I thought it was a reality show.
Me too. I read this press release.
But then Harold Perrineau from Lost, I butchered his name, but the guy from Lost is in it apparently. And then like the producers who are... from the Asylum, those like mock buster guys, like they do like, you know, American Battleship. They produced it.
That's why I was confused.
Yeah, I'm so confused by it. But apparently they said that they can actually compete with The Walking Dead. I'm like, okay. All right, sure. The Walking Dead's got its own problems. Leave The Walking Dead alone. They got their own
Maybe
problems.
Maybe you don't want to compete with The Walking Dead. Maybe you want to improve on them.
Yeah, exactly.
I just did a genre vlog about The Walking Dead. It's up on my YouTube channel if you want to know my thoughts on The Walking Dead.
Hey, Clark, where's your YouTube channel at?
Oh, it's at youtube.com/officialclarkwolf.
Official Clark Wolf.
Yeah, because Clark Wolf was taken.
Yeah.
But it's not .clark/horror/ wolf.facebook.
Hey, man.
Like yours.
Listen, yeah.
So could, much punctuation, Ryan.
Yeah, yeah.
So much useless punctuation.
I'm full of punctuation. Full of exclamation points.
Yeah.
You can find me on facebook.com/RyanTurek.horror.
.ca.
So yeah, that wraps up, I think, our Guillermo chat. What is the one project that you were looking forward to, or that you are looking forward to, that Guillermo is currently attached to?
I would love to see his take on Pinocchio.
You
are clearly not impressed. I think what about a rated R Pinocchio in the vein of Pan's Labyrinth, like a real grim, gross fairy tale about bringing a little boy to life.
Yeah, if it turned into like this reverse creature feature where you're introduced to the creature and then he becomes more human and it's just as terrifying as a man turning to a monster, I'd be game for that.
I think he could really do cool stuff with a Pinocchio legend. I know Frankenstein, he was recently in the news because he was quoted as saying, you know, he's even afraid. He's afraid to do it because it's his dream.
Yeah, I don't know where that can fit into anything that they're doing at Universal now. I wrote about this on Shock. I did a piece about the Universal monster universe that they're pulling together Avengers style. And it's kind of like, unless they already have it mapped out with the other creators who were previously attached to other monster movies, I think Kurtzman's on his own. He's just like, fuck it, I got my own vision.
Is his Frankenstein story set up at Universal?
Guillermo? Yeah, I believe so.
Really?
Yeah.
It's not at Warner Brothers?
Well, no. No, it's at Universal because he wants to do like a Frankenstein.
So like a
Karloff-esque kind of thing.
Mm.
I thought the weird thing with Frankenstein, it I don't even know if it has a home. I'd have to like do like some heavy research and look at news. I don't even know if it has a home because honestly, I think it began with Guillermo going, I've got a Frankenstein script. And then I ran into, I interviewed Guillermo and I asked him who he wanted to play Frankenstein's monster. And he said, Doug Jones. And then I met Doug Jones on the set on the red carpet for Hellboy 2. And I said, did you know that you might be Frankenstein's monster? And he was like, what? And then he gave me a big Doug Jones hug and he was all excited. So then those two were tied together. But Guillermo always wanted to do a Frankenstein that was kind of inspired by Bernie Wrightson's Frankenstein, apparently. But I don't know. I don't know where it's all.
Well, because Frankenstein is public domain.
It's public domain, yeah. That's why Fox is doing their Victor Frankenstein
Anybody
movie.
Anybody could do a Frankenstein movie. Yeah, I would say Pinocchio. I would love to, but I would also really love to see him get to be the one to tackle Lovecraft.
Yeah.
I think that would be really cool. What about you?
I don't know. I mean, like, I want to see, At the Mountains of Madness for sure. What?
I am so full of shit.
What?
Justice League Dark. I want to see Guillermo del Toro's Justice League Dark. That goes number one, then Pinocchio, maybe. And then, basically, I just want all of them.
I couldn't be less interested in Justice League Dark.
I couldn't. Why? They're all my favorite people.
They're great characters, and I'd love to see, you know, Guillermo do, like, a cool swamp thing. But, honestly, it's, like, one of these things where it just feels like they're shoehorning, they're trying to force a property that isn't Guillermo onto Guillermo and going, hey, Guillermo-ify this, please, and do something cool with it. And I'm kind of like, even though we just talked about how he put his stamp on Blade 2 and
Hellboy. About Joss Whedon and the Avengers. That, to me, is like such a good fit. And think about James Gunn and Guardians. What a good fit.
Yeah.
And think about Justice League Dark and Guillermo.
Think about the critters.
And you don't think that's a perfect fit?
It is.
Forget about all the other.
It is a fit.
Justice League and Batman and dumb things that I
hate.
Listen,
I mean, here's the thing. He left us hanging with Hellboy 2. I need to see Hellboy 3.
Speak for yourself.
He's going to have babies.
What?
And Hellboy. At the end of Hellboy 2.
Oh, I thought you meant Guillermo. I was like, hold on.
No, Guillermo's got kids. Hellboy is going to have twins and he's going to become the creature of the apocalypse. Those are two, literally, fatherhood, creature of the apocalypse, rife with tension and angst.
It is a good idea.
And great stuff.
But I want Justice League Dark. I want a cool Zatanna. Yeah, you know I'm never going to let that go.
Yeah.
And I want him to do it. They will. She is. It's confirmed. He okay. already said she's John Constantine's girlfriend and it's happening and she's a badass on her own. And he already said that it's about her and John Constantine.
Well, interesting.
Yeah. So shush.
But listen, what is paramount? At some point he needs to do at the Mountains.
I'm sorry, I totally cut you off. No, I'm really sorry.
It's fine. No. I completely forgot about Justice League Dark. What should be priority number one is at the Mountains of Madness. And to be completely frank, I don't care if Tom Cruise is in it. I want to see Tom Cruise in it. Give me a Tom Cruise, Guillermo del Toro movie that is high adventure, bleak is fucking all weird, galactic terror, unknown, Lovecraftian shenanigans. Give me all of that, man. I'm down.
I think Tom Cruise needs to go for it in a dark kind of way.
Yeah.
Give him something really gnarly. It would be a wonderful, very cool and unique pairing.
Yeah. Yeah. That'd be awesome. And you know what's interesting? This book, Guillermo del Toro, Cabinet of Curiosities, he reveals that he went in to pitch I Am Legend.
Sorry, keep going.
Oh, I was going to say, and I was like, I read further. I was like, oh, well, let me know more. And he said that basically it was when Arnold Schwarzenegger was attached. And Guillermo always thought the lead character is basically a monster. The lead is basically a monster. You know, I mean, he's a monster to these vampires. You know, he's a threat to these vampires.
And he's a drunk.
And yeah, he's a drunk. And, you know, he shouldn't be larger than life. The vampires are. And he felt that Arnold Schwarzenegger was larger than life and, you know, couldn't fit. So they were like, okay, thank you, bye.
Yeah, they wanted to make an action movie. Yeah. They didn't want to stay true to the book.
Right.
And it's funny you said Tom Cruise and Guillermo doing Lovecraft because that is original. What I thought of was Francis Lawrence and Will Smith and how excited I was at the potential of Will Smith actually playing this character and like really doing something dark and kind of shunning the good guy image. Yeah. And then I saw the movie and I was like, oh, so the opposite of that.
Yeah, exactly.
And so if Tom Cruise would actually get on board with Guillermo and actually get on board and go for it and go dark like Magnolia Dark, mm-hmm. then I'm on board. But if it's not going to be that, then no thank you.
Yeah, I don't know. He's just got to find the right home for it or like, you know, the right people.
The right monies.
The right money. Get the monies, Guillermo.
Man.
All right. So cool, man.
Awesome.
I thought that was a good discussion on Guillermo. We're patting ourselves on the back as we close out our 87th episode.
Pat.
Plug away, Clark. What do you got?
Yeah. So please feel free to join me over on my YouTube channel. Once again, what are you laughing at?
Please feel free to join me.
Well, I don't want to tell anybody what to do. Free will, but if you want. So it's youtube.com/officialclarkwolf and Facebook is facebook.com/officialclarkwolf and Twitter and Instagram are at Clark Wolf.
You can find me at _RyanTurek on Twitter or at STYD News. And as always, you could find me at shocktillyoudrop.com. I also want to plug HorrorCal for those who live in the Los Angeles area. HorrorCal is your number one source for all horror events. We are telling you what's going on throughout the city that are horror related. Screenings and signings and stage productions and haunts as we lurch into the Halloween season. We're actually putting haunts on there. So horrorcal.com, and you can actually subscribe to it and add it to your Google Calendar or iCal.
Excellent. That was a great plug. Very nice. So you're so enthusiastic, Ryan.
No, this is my...
Holy smokes. We went for like a million years.
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
All right, we're going to wrap it up.
Okay. Yeah. Bye-bye, guys.
Bye.